Writer Kurt Vonnegut died Wednesday in New York at the age of 84. His wife, photographer Jill Kremenz, reported he'd suffered irreversible brain injuries after a fall several weeks ago. Vonnegut wrote plays, essays, and short stories, but it was his 14 novels that made him a literary icon, especially popular on college campuses. They were a unique blend of science fiction, humor, and philosophy, often dealing with dark themes of human cruelty. His first novel, Player Piano, was written in 1952. Timequake, published in 1997, was his 14th and final novel. Vonnegut was born in Indianapolis in 1922. He served in an infantry unit in World War II, and after seeing action at the Battle of the Bulge, was imprisoned in an underground meat locker in Dresden when the city was firebombed by Allied forces. The experience would form the basis of his best-known novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, published in 1972. Though now required reading in many literature classes, for years it was banned from some school and library shelves. Terry Gross spoke with Kurt Vonnegut in 1986. He described how he survived the firebombing of Dresden.
Well, it was merely a matter of luck, as there were no air raid shelters in Dresden because an air raid was not expected. The Germans had believed it to be an open city. There, in fact, is no convention in war. I guess there was in medieval times, but they did not expect an attack, and there didn't seem to be any strong reason to attack it, so there were no air raid shelters. And it was a beautiful city like Vienna or Budapest or Prague. And one night, as the British came over, they're the ones who did the firebombing, really. The Americans dropped the high explosives. But the whole city was burned down, and all there was to hide in was cellars. And we happened to be quartered. Our work crew of American prisoners of war was quartered in a slaughterhouse. One thing, there weren't many buildings around. There were just a few large buildings, so the firestorm wasn't very intense there. Also, we were in a meat locker way under the street, so it would have been the place for Hitler to be, anybody to be. It was the safest place in Dresden, accidentally. So that's how I survived.
And then when the bombing was over, you had to go upstairs and dig out corpses.
Well, what we did first was the city had to cool off before we could walk around. I mean, it was like a volcano or something like that. You had to wait for the lava to cool off, but we stayed down for quite a while, I forget how long, and finally came back up. And then we had to walk and walk and walk until we could find someplace else to stay. There was nobody to lead us. I mean, we just had guards who were corporals and privates and sergeants, and they didn't know where the hell to go, and there was nobody for them to ask. So they marched us out on the edge of town and found us a place to stay out there. But then the city began to get organized, what was left of it and all that, and we were organized into work crews to go in and dig bodies out from underneath the street. And I have looked at movies of the liberation of concentration camps in Germany, where the SS was made to carry the corpses to the lime pits or to the graves or whatever, while a whole lot of people watched. And the moral situation isn't analogous at all, but the political situation is I have carried corpses while civilians watched and thought it served me right to be carrying corpses.
What do you mean?
Because I was an American and the corpses had been created by Americans and British.
When did you realize you were going to write about it? Was it then or years later?
I felt that it just kept nagging at me. It took me a while to realize that this was an important historical event, and it turns out to have been the largest massacre in European history. Now, massacre is something that happened suddenly. As heaven knows, Auschwitz killed many, many more people, but slowly, you know, in an industrial manner, and in just one big whoosh of killing a whole lot of people suddenly, Dresden held the record, and I had been there. And so I decided, gee, I'd better write about this because I was a professional writer and I was always casting about for what to write about next. It took me a long time to do.
Did the writing about it change the way you remembered it? Did it bring back memories that you hadn't remembered, you know, things that you hadn't remembered? Or did you see it through a different filter because you were older then and had experienced more?
Well, for one thing, I had one of the filters I'd seen it through was war movies about World War II and war books. And, of course, they featured Frank Sinatra and Duke Wayne and all that. And it took me a long time to realize that this war was, in fact, fought by children, you know, and not these middle-aged 4F movie actors. And so that's what one thing made the book bizarre, that, in fact, the infantrymen were teenagers, which is not usual in an American war story.
You've joked that you're not only one of the few survivors of that bombing, but you're the only person to have made a profit from it, because through royalties for your book, you've made about $3 per person killed in Dresden. And I was wondering if you had ever experienced what's sometimes called survivor's guilt.
Probably in some other situations, not the Dresden situation. I did lose several friends. There were 100 of us in that prisoner of war camp, a little labor gang in Dresden, and 5% of us died, didn't make it back home for one reason or another. That's not enough to give you survivor's guilt, I guess. I will issue the challenge again here, because a lot of people get mad at me for having talked about the destruction of a Nazi city, you know, and I saw it, which is the reason I wrote about it, and there's no reason for me to keep it secret that I saw it. But another thing is that absolutely nothing was gained by it, and I'll issue the challenge again here, that nobody in this whole world benefited from that air raid but me. That not one person got out of Auschwitz a microsecond earlier, not one German soldier fell back from his foxhole on the Russian front or the American front. Nothing was changed at all. And that I'm the only person who benefited, and I get $3 and maybe $4 for each person killed there. And so this is going out over radio. I've done it on BBC and so forth, and that first letter has yet to float in. It's, hey, if it weren't for Dresden, whatever.
As popular as your books are, they've also been banned by some school libraries, by some regular libraries. How do you usually find out about it? What do they tell you? And do you find out directly from the person who banned the book when it's banned?
No. You pick it up from newspapers, or you hear talk or whatever. You have to chase down cases of censorship, and of course it's a huge country. My publisher and I have an agreement that whenever we hear of such a case, that our primary interest is in offering help to the librarian or the teacher who has gotten into trouble as a result of recommending a book by me. And we also tell the ACLU, I can't think of a case that we've reported to the ACLU that they didn't already know, because they have chapters all over the country, and I have no such spy system out. So it's catch as catch can as I hear about it. There's no reason for me ever to testify in court, and so I'm not a participant in any censorship case.
Can you describe some of the passages in your book that are responsible for them being banned?
No, and neither can the book banners, as they customarily haven't read them. And these are nice people. They're usually not very well educated. They have kids. They want to help the community in some way. They run for the school committee. And so suddenly, for the first time in their lives, they are dealing with books since high school or whatever. And so they are over their heads. But there are organizations which will give them lists of bad books, which they don't even have to read. Are these books on your shelves? And so they will go, and indeed some of them are. There's an awful lot of them are out of print. There's apparently the basic list, which includes Slaughterhouse-Five. It also includes Deliverance and Catcher in the Rye. Apparently it was circulated. It's just Xerox now. It was apparently circulated by 1971 because no book on it was published after that time. A lot of the books on that list are out of print now, as they're so unpopular. I get letters from the Soviet Union. I'm published over there. I get letters of sympathy saying that they're so sorry my books are being burned over here, and that they want me to know that my books will always be available over there. Obviously, in the Soviet Union, they've made a great deal of the very minor and rare cases of censorship in this country. I think what's new is not the censorship, but the opposition to censorship. As I think for 200 years, people have been perfectly free to censor school libraries, public libraries. Nobody's opposed them. And what is new is that suddenly they're being opposed.
You've taught writing, and you've taught it over a period of several years. Yet, when you were young and first starting to write, you'd never been a student of writing or been a student of literature as your major in college. Do you think that hurt or helped you in any way? Because you were a major in science, not in literature or writing.
No, if I had met someone like myself, I would have felt a lot more confident about becoming a writer, and I also would have known a lot. Almost everything I found out about writing, I learned the hard way, whereas in fact it was all in Aristotle's Poetics. Now, there are a few fundamental things that are known about storytelling, simply because some stories have succeeded and others have failed. So I can be like a golf pro. Is I can stand to one side and tell you to swing your club, and I'll say, all right, put a little more weight on your left foot, is move your thumb down a quarter of an inch, and the ball will go 50 feet farther, and you won't yourself know what the hell you were doing wrong, and there are things you can do wrong in storytelling. I mean, these are mechanical things. So I can be helpful in that way.
Because you weren't studying literature and because you didn't have teachers criticizing your writing, was writing more fun to you when you were younger than it might have been if you were a serious student of
reading,
it?
Reading was a lot more fun, too. I've never done. I've always read for pleasure, and I've never had to explain afterwards what the author had done to prove that I had understood the book at all. Writers will come out of almost any department but the English department. And this is not to insult English departments. When I say this in a lecture, everybody says, oh, yeah, hoo-hoo, what a bunch of jerks in the English department. Well, it's not the purpose of an English department to turn out creative writers. It's to turn out literary historians, cultivated people, and people who will in turn teach people the wonders of their language and their literature. And but one thing an English department will do, will teach you good taste too soon. And so when you can't write very well but are starting out, you will be horrified when you compare yourself with James Joyce at the peak of his powers, or Proust or Mark Twain or whatever. And so when I was in the chemistry department at Cornell, writing for the Cornell Sun, I thought everything was wonderful. And I thought what I was doing, you know, I didn't know any better, so I dared to begin.
I hesitate to ask you this, but do you have any books of yours that are to you representative of your best work? Are there ones that you are?
Oh, well, there are ones I'm particularly fond of, sure. I've graded them one time. I gave grades to all my books, and it was just how I felt that day about each book. But I'm very pleased with my career. Here I am, 64 years old, or 62, and I never expected to write this many books and to be satisfied to the extent I am with them, because my grades weren't particularly good in school, and prognosis did not seem good.
So I'm proud to have finished the book.
I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us.
Well, pleasure.
Kurt Vonnegut speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. Vonnegut died Wednesday in New York. He was 84.